Hey guys, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for over 10 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures, how through them God has made himself known to us, and his ultimate desire to dwell among us.
We want to invite you to join us on this journey as God reveals himself to us through his word.
We also want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
So I am a big time sucker for Instagram memes. Like I'm constantly just like going through my explore section, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And generally now I've got it narrowed down to where everything's about like, it's like funny parent memes or like, you know, everything's funny. Everything's funny that I kind of am going through. And if it's not, then I just like skip right over it.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to start today, you know, along the lines of the old Greedo thing we've had going on the past couple weeks, which he still is hurting.
But today it magically got better. It, you know, we're watching or we're reading all of these healing, you know, miracle stories. Well, today I'm just sitting at my desk and I have minding my own business, hurting. And all of a sudden, like two vertebrae just randomly pop in my back. So then all of a sudden, I feel so much better.
He comes home tonight and he shuts the dishwasher. And he goes, "Did you see that? I just shut the dishwasher." I was like, "Oh my gosh, yeah. You've got to be kidding me!" But anyway, so there's been a lot lately of memes that I've seen that go something like this: one day you're young and free, the next you catch yourself saying aloud, "That's a good looking fence."
Yeah.
And so I just kind of wanted to mention I had a moment like this not that long ago where I found myself saying or thinking something that I was like, man, I'm getting old. Mm-hmm. And that was, so we got a new Roomba because okay.
I was actually going to bring it up.
Okay. So we got a new Roomba and, you know, now that we have Maggie, this is the first time we've had a dog that sheds at our house. So, cause our Shih Tzus don't shed. And so we were, you know, we went back and forth. We was like, that seems silly to get a Roomba. I mean, I'm a stay at home mom. I can vacuum, but then we got it. And I just sit there watching it. Like, this is amazing. And I'm like, I took a picture of it and I sent it to my sister or not the actual vacuum, but the room it had finished. Sent the picture to my sister. And I was like, check out these vacuum lines. And the best part was she was like, you know, yes, those are awesome. You know, it's like, she's also old.
Yeah.
And so, it just kind of made me laugh that like, okay, this is who I am now.
Yeah. Well, and I would find myself just following him around, which by the way,
yeah, he'd be like, where's Fred? That's the name of our Roomba.
Yeah. We asked Caleb, what do we want to name, the Roomba? And he just immediately blurts out Fred.
Yeah.
So we named it Fred and it's connected to our Google stuff. So all we have to do is say, hey, Google, have Fred vacuum the office, you know, and Fred will make his little way over to the office and vacuum.
Yeah.
Vacuum. And so I absolutely, and then, and so like on my phone, it'll tell me like, hey, you know, Fred completed a job today. You know, like if Melissa has him vacuum, then it'll give me an alert, say Fred completed a job. Well, also it'll tell me like if something gets caught up in it, I'll get a notification that says like Fred requires your attention or Fred needs your assistance. And I was like, well, that'd be kind of a good way to get out of a conversation that you feel stuck in. Like, hey, listen,
sorry,
Fred's calling me right now.
He requires my assistance. It's urgent.
It's all true.
So what's funny is like, if you've been gone and you're coming home and Fred was vacuuming while you were gone, you're like, where is Fred? Yeah. Like you're like, Fred, like as though he's going to respond and be like, I'm over here stuck on this wire or whatever. So yeah, we're old now.
But we love our Roomba.
Fred, we heart you forever.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I thought that would be a fun little way to introduce this podcast. It has nothing to do with what we're studying, unless we can find some random connection as we work our way through this. But yeah, so we just if you have anything where you have felt like, wow, I'm really old because I got excited about this, like super mundane thing, then let us know.
Yeah. All right. So I guess we will make that perfect segue into
it's beautiful
into the scripture for today. So we're going to pick up again in Matthew chapter 9. And as we've mentioned before, we're in this anthology of various miracles that Jesus is doing, demonstrating his authority. Last week, we covered the healing of the paralytic, which demonstrates Jesus's authority to forgive sins, which is something, again, that only Yahweh can do. Like, only Yahweh has the authority to forgive sins. And so he's very much aligning himself with Yahweh as if he is Yahweh, which Matthew's case would be he is. And then in this calling of various disciples and it being, you know, these tax collectors and sinners, these people that have been longing for a way back into God's community that's been kept from them. You can tell in the reading that it just seems like they've been longing for that opportunity to come back. And whenever Jesus is here forgiving sins, you know, and he has the authority to forgive sins, you see them being attracted to him and coming to him, and he feasts with them, and there's this, it's really intimate. And also opposition to that. We've started to see more opposition as we gone along with the Pharisees and the scribes, people that are honestly, I mean, the Bible teachers of their day. So it should be fairly humbling to somebody like me, you know, that talk about loving to read scripture and all that stuff. The people that do that within here too are kind of, they're critiqued a lot because they don't get it. And it's kind of a shame, but, and that's kind of Jesus's point, is like, hey, you're missing the point of the scriptures. You're missing the point of Hosea, that I desire mercy, not sacrifice, which is highlighting that God desires to bind up his people, when I say bind up, I mean that they've been put them in prison. No, actually, that they've been broken, and he desires to heal them. I mean, and that's kind of, these are symbols of that as we've gone along, that this is, you know, God's desire is to seek out the broken and to bind them back up and to heal them and rejoin them to him and reconcile with them. That's his whole reason for being here, is to deal with the thing that's separating God's people from him, and those that, you know. So anyways, he challenges the Pharisees to remember even what the scriptures are about, that God desires and longs to be among his people. And so he calls them back to that remembrance and gives them what they need to see that what he's doing is actually bringing the kingdom. And then had a bit about fasting as well. And I think we talked about it's the same things. He's highlighting that, look, the heart that which you maybe were doing it with, it needs to change. You're not fasting so that you can gain points with God.
Favor
with God. Fasting is going to come whenever his disciples are, you know, really longing for the bridegroom's return. And that right now, I mean, it's a time for rejoicing. And so anyways, that's just kind of a short synopsis of where we were. And we're going to continue the theme of Jesus's authority and his healing of his people and demonstrating who he is and what he's like. And so we'll pick up in this, this first section. Before we do start reading, I do just want to make a note. So the two things that are about to come up are this, the healing or the raising or resurrection of a girl who has died, and also of a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. And what's pointed, I think what you obviously notice with Matthew whenever you read maybe the other gospels, is how much shorter it is. Mm-hmm. He's taking out a lot of words. R.T. France points out that Matthew needs a mere 48 words for the woman with the hemorrhage or the bleeding compared to Mark's 154. So 48, he cuts it by a third in the number of words. And then for the resurrection of the girl, he uses 90 words versus 192 words in Mark's gospel. So he's really, he's done that to a lot of different stories that we've read through here, as he's really whittled it down. And again, it's for a, to give you a thrust of like a point that he's trying to get at, and not distract you with other things where maybe Mark is trying to tell you more of, here's the whole story. Matthew's trying to get a point across. And so let's pay attention for that. So why don't you read this first section?
While he was saying this, a ruler came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said, "your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed from that moment. When Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, "Go away, the girl is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through that region.
Okay. So what you immediately see, what immediately comes up is that there's this ruler. And really, so this is more maybe properly stated an official. So he's not like somebody that rules over the city. Mm-hmm. He's an official, and you'll get from the other gospels that he's part of the synagogue. Right. And so, anyways, he seems to be somebody that, you know, maybe does hold some clout, in their city, but he's not like a ruler, mm-hmm. like the Romans type thing.
Yeah.
And so he immediately comes to him, and you can just see this person, you know, falling down in front of him and saying, "My daughter has died." And he's crying out to him. So what are your first thoughts on that?
So knowing that he is, like a synagogue official, mm-hmm. My thoughts about that are that he would have to be, I'll say either or, really brave to come to Jesus, like knowing that the Pharisees might look at him like, "Why are you going to this Jesus guy? Like, we don't really trust him." Mm-hmm. Or desperate,
yeah.
that this is his only hope at getting his daughter back.
Yeah. I mean, he's desperate. But also, I mean, this seems to be in Capernaum, and you see all these mm-hmm. things that Jesus is doing. And so he's kind of putting things together, maybe, and he realizes something about Jesus that, like, he can't explain, maybe, but he is stepping out there, and he's got more to lose than other people.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why Mark points him out as an official, and he leaves that. He doesn't remove that like he removes other things. He leaves that. This is an official. He kind of has some things to lose by coming to this person that clearly the Pharisees are kind of at odds with.
Right.
So he also said, I mean, and with this person kind of, he probably knows the scriptures, but he makes the point to say, "My daughter has just now died, but come place your hand on her, you know, and she will live." So he knows that she's dead. She's very clearly died. And at least within mm-hmm. the way Matthew is telling it, and he specifically says to place her hand on her. And R.T. France makes the note of, like, due to the taboo of touching a dead body, it is surprising that the request is specifically to lay his hand on her. One of the themes of this passage seems to revolve around this is actually my note, not R.T. France. Sorry. If he ever listens to this, I'm not giving you credit on that. This one. So one of the themes of the passage seems to revolve around Jesus's contagious holiness. Instead of death or blood causing Jesus to become unclean, his holiness goes out from him and makes them whole.
Mm-hmm.
And so this placing the hand on her, you know, it should make him unclean, but it's almost like this guy kind of knows something. He's already seen the leper, like maybe he's already seen the leper. We've seen the leper, right? And Jesus touches the leper and he doesn't become unclean. The leper becomes whole.
Right.
Jesus' contagious holiness. These are two things that aren't supposed to mix, of holiness and uncleanness. I think we covered that in the leper podcast.
Where
we talked about the leper.
Yeah, I know.
Like, instead of the uncleanness making Jesus also unclean, his holiness makes them whole. And so here it seems like he kind of he's at least aware of something that it's not going to make Judas unclean. He says, I know she's going to live if you touch her. And so there's certainly this kind of faith, this trust in Jesus and what he can do, that's being displayed by him that's unusual. So, you want to continue in the story here? So what, I guess it gets interrupted, right?
Yeah.
And so what are your thoughts on the interruption?
Well, I wanted to point out as well that at the beginning of this section, they were also interrupted too. By this ruler, by this official, he had been...
Oh, as he was saying these things.
Yeah. Okay. Jesus had been talking, you know, about the whole fasting issue, and he's interrupted, and he recognizes that this is an important thing that needs to be done. Who knows? Maybe the fasting conversation would have gone on longer. Maybe we would have, you know, maybe it would have...
Maybe my questions would have been answered if he hadn't been interrupted by this man that just wants his daughter to be raised from the dead.
Right. So
selfishness.
But then, so here we see he is interrupted again. And I just took it as like, yeah, this another interruption. And then I kind of saw it from a reverse way of this woman was trying so hard not to interrupt Jesus.
Yeah.
But to go back to this idea though of him being interrupted before I get into that part of it, is that it's kind of amazing to me that obviously Jesus knew what he was going to do was really important. Like going to heal this child was mm-hmm. like a significant thing he was going to do,
mm-hmm.
but that didn't mean he was too busy.
Yeah.
For other people that were in need on the way.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something to be said about that. For how we operate is that like sometimes we can be so hyper focused on things that we just like let other needs slide by without just taking a moment to pause and seeing if there's something we need to like handle there.
Yeah. You know? I would think it, what's odd about it is it feel like you feel like the focus should be on this girl died, and instead, he kind of stops it. And it's not like he doesn't seem to be in this huge rush to,
right.
There's kind of multiple layers of faith and trust here in that. I mean, I don't think in any of the other gospels that mention this, it's not like the man is like, because I would expect if I was the father,
I would be like, Jesus.
Hey, come on. That's great and all, but let's do this. You know, but at the same time, it's like, she's dead. Like, how much worse could it get? You know, kind of thing. And so anyways, the kind of the interruption, this is a serious one for it to interrupt. And it just seems to be like, he just rolls with it.
Well, I mean, I specifically wrote like, he meets interruptions with grace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something that I am really bad about with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, if they interrupt something that I'm doing, I do not always meet that with grace, you know, of like, what do you like?
Yeah.
What
well,
do you
I,
need?
So as a supervisor now, one of my continual things is I have to, I am constantly like the moment I try to get focused on something, somebody walks up to my desk and says, mm-hmm. Hey Garrett, what are your thoughts on this? What do I need to do about that? Hey Garrett, you know, it's like, and then once the one person walks away, you can tell the next person that walks up is smiling because they're like, I'm so sorry to interrupt you again, but I need you to answer this thing. It's also my job to be patient, you know, and say like, they need my input on certain things. They need my direction. And so I, you know, where I'm certainly not raising people from the dead,
but
you know, I can understand at least to some level of that, you know, how that could just be bothersome, but at the same time, he just seems to be so full of grace with it. It just rolls with it because they need him.
Right.
But
what I was saying was, it does seem like she tried not to interrupt him. Like, I think she would have rather just touch his cloak, he not notice, and she be healed and never even speak to him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just thinking about how, like, she was probably embarrassed about her situation. Maybe she didn't feel like worthy to talk to him or to ask him for that.
Yeah.
But she, you know, I was seeing a lot of parallels between these two, two individuals who have come to Jesus. And, you know, we see the desperation of the ruler of the synagogue official to be like, this is my last chance. This is my only hope, mm-hmm. is if Jesus can heal her or, you know, yeah. restore her. And for this woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, this is a desperate moment.
Yeah.
This is her. I mean, I think she's probably like, if this doesn't work,
then nothing
will work.
Yeah.
And so there's that parallel between these two. And I think there's a lot of parallels, I feel like, but there's, this idea that they were put together by Matthew because they share so much in common, even though they have such different roles and situations.
Yeah. This is R.T. France here. He says, each is concerned with a woman, and each raises the issue of ritual purity. Since both a woman with discharge of blood and a dead body would rendered unclean anyone who touched them, in a sense, each of these women is restored to life. The one literally and the other metaphorically, in that she's freed from 12 years of social restriction. So she probably, you know, with this continual bleeding, she's been separated. You know, and even for her to be here is a risk for her, of what could happen. But yeah, she does have this faith that if she can just touch the edge of his cloak, that mm-hmm. She says it, you know, or, you know, for she said to herself, if only I can touch the edge of his cloak, the word's actually saved, that I'll be saved. Mm-hmm. It gets translated, I think, often as healed, because it makes it, you know, like you can see that she's healed, but she uses the word for saved. I'll be saved. I'll have salvation. And then it's actually repeated again whenever that Jesus turns around and sees her. He says, have courage, daughter. And he uses very tender language for, you know, like, a, you know, like he's, it's very personal. Mm-hmm. As you would talk to your own daughter, have courage, daughter, your trust or your faith has saved you. And then it says, then again, and the woman was saved from that hour. And so there's this salvation aspect of it. And my note for that, was that literally, saved three times is repeated. This is the same word that's used in the Septuagint to describe Israel's deliverance from Egypt. Like the Israelites, she has been delivered from death into life. And so I think that, you know, that's something that we need to be able to see here, is like Jesus is bringing about salvation for his people. And this is a small taste of that that's happening.
Yeah.
So one other note on this, the woman with the bleeding. I hear a distinct echo. And actually, I recognize this echo whenever I read through Zechariah in a Bible study. So the same word for this, edge of the cloak. Okay. Edge of the cloak. It's the same word used in Zechariah 8:23, same word in the Septuagint for Zechariah 8:23. It says, thus says Yahweh of hosts, in those days, 10 men from the nations of every language will take hold of the hem or the edge of a Judean man. Okay, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. And Zechariah 8 is about how Yahweh will restore his remnant. Young and old will be full of joy, even if it seems like an impossibility. Like, because they're in exile at that time in Zechariah. Like, it just seems unthinkable that they would be returned to Yahweh. He proclaims that he will bring his people from the east and from the west. We've heard this before, right? The banquet. That he talks about with the Gentile, and they will be my people and I will be their God, right? In faithfulness and in righteousness. Zechariah also encourages the remnant to, quote, speak truth with their neighbor, practice trustworthy judgment and peace, and not devise evil in your hearts against your neighbor, which you're going to see. We've already seen people devising evil in their heart, which is the Pharisees or the scribes. There, he says, why do you think evil? Or why do you think bad in your heart? Instead, he says, I made a note of that's what the scribes say in the previous story. And then he calls them, he says that the fasts are turned to jubilation and joy and merry festivals. Therefore, love, truth, and peace. So, and then the story right before this, we had a fasting. We had a discussion on why you don't fast. And he's like, no, this is a time of jubilation. And so anyways, all that to say, I think one effect of this wording would be to recall the ingathering and healing of Israel. Also, it also includes the nations coming to know Yahweh. So if you hear that echo from Zechariah, you would remember that, hey, this is including all people being gathered back and Yahweh healing his people. And so she's a symbol of that. She's a, you know, walking, talking symbol of it. So anyways, I know that was probably a lot, but whenever you read it, whenever I read Zechariah, I was like, this so distinctly sounds like what happens in Matthew chapter 9.
Yeah.
And so anyways, I think that a reader of the Hebrew Bible notices those types of things, which is who Matthew is writing to. So, anyways, so, all right. So Jesus, you have any other thoughts on her?
Well, it's kind of both. So just continue. Okay.
All right. So he's had the interruption and he turns to her and he, you know, tells her that her faith, you know, that, you know, your faith has healed you. And now he continues on, and he sees this, all these flute players and, you know, disorderly crowd, that's there. And he tells them to go away. She's only sleeping. You have any thoughts on that section?
Well, just pointing out that the flute players are there for lamenting purposes. Yeah. It's not just like a random band that, right, you know, popped through there. Right. They're there to pay respect, I guess, to this girl who has passed away. So that's kind of a big deal to come in and be like, go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, he just outright just tells them to get, you know. But the thing that he says is that she's not dead, but she's sleeping. And they actually laugh at him. They just outright laugh at him. And this is, again, I try to check back in the Septuagint, see like where certain words have been used for Old Testament stories. And so this is what Sarah does whenever she laughs about having the possibility that in her old age, in their old age, having a child, it's an impossibility.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So like it's something that seems absolutely impossible. And it's such a ridiculous statement. How could you make such a statement? It's stupid. In Jesus's case, and in this story's case, even death itself has to submit its authority to Jesus. To the author of creation, raising someone from the dead is as straightforward as waking somebody up from their sleep. Because she's certainly dead. But Jesus, he sees it even, not even as a challenge. It's just like you're just going to shake her awake, you know?
Yeah. You know, that this, you know, we've talked all along how Matthew has this whole authority thing, mm-hmm, with showing Jesus's authority. And so this is obviously one of the most amazing miracles because it does seem so impossible. But it shows that Jesus is God and it shows his authority over death. But I think the coolest thing that I realize is like this is kind of a precursor of him showing his ultimate authority over death through, mm-hmm, his crucifixion and resurrection.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like, I don't usually think about, put those dots together when I've heard this story, but it's just really kind of showing like, yeah, Jesus doesn't just resurrect this girl.
Yeah.
You know, like this is not the only time this happens, but, and so I don't know. I just thought that connection was really cool of kind of like, this is a kind of a foreshadow moment.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And he does it. What's clear about this is that he does this without anybody else, without anybody but his disciples around, because it says that they sent everybody out. I think it would have been a big deal if right there everybody had seen him raise her from the dead, because of the implications it would be to what everybody would want him to do at that moment, mm-hmm, you know, of that sort of authority and all of it. I mean, Matthew's whole point is this is Yahweh God.
Yeah.
This is none other. And actually this echoes distinctly with, so there's two, in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, Elijah and Elisha will both raise children from the dead. and they call on Yahweh. So, but you don't see that with Jesus. He doesn't call on Yahweh. He just speaks it and it happens. You know, like he's doing with but a word, you know, and actually I think he just takes her hand. In Matthew's story, he just takes her hand and she gets up. And this is so, it both echoes back to Elijah and Elisha, but in those stories, they do so much more. They have to do so much more in calling on Yahweh to raise these children from the dead. And also, those are also done in secret. So, or mm-hmm. done in private rooms. It says they close the door behind them or whatever. And so this very much echoes it and it calls you back to look at it. And when you compare them, you say like, I mean, all Jesus did was just take her hand. Mm-hmm. You know, and so he is the one that Elijah and Elisha called on.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's certainly a really powerful story and demonstrating, of course, Jesus's authority over the thing that seems to have authority over everybody else.
Yeah.
Whenever it comes to him, he tells death what to do.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So, any other thoughts?
Well, my final thought, I guess, on this entire section is just a theme that I felt like I noticed was this seek and you shall find.
Hmm.
I kept thinking about what we read in chapter 7.
Yeah.
When, you know, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open to you. And, you know, we probably talked about in that podcast about how some people want to use that as like almost a genie thing, mm-hmm. of like, I can ask for anything I want and God will give it to me. But I think that this is showing that this idea of seeking and finding is these two stories, they're seeking Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, you have to take it away from the like specific healing of or the raising of the dead. They're ultimately what they're doing is seeking out Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just think, you know, not that every situation is going to end up like this, but it's showing an example of the kind of faith that Jesus was talking about on the Sermon on the Mount of seeking out Jesus, mm-hmm. not seeking out specific things, but seeking out Jesus and you're going to find him.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and they do ask for, you know, he's like, hey, my daughter's died, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
But the purpose of the story isn't to say, well, you've just got to have the right faith and then you can have whatever healing or whatever money or whatever,
right.
whatever prosperity that you want. You just got to have the right faith for it. Instead, it's just, continually demonstrating, who Jesus is and what he's like and his compassion, and demonstrating him as a trustworthy person, a person that's worthy of trust. I got a note for that later. But yeah, it's not just like a open, a blank check to just say, or even one that's just putting it on you to be like, well, just have enough faith.
Right.
I don't think that's what's being asked, especially for the girl. I mean, how could she have faith? She's dead.
Right. Right. Well, the faith of her father.
Right. But the trust of her father, is what, you know, he asks for some level. He does invite them into trust, mm-hmm. but the whole point is to demonstrate him as the trustworthy one. So she gets up from the dead, and it's going to hardly be easy to keep it under wraps that a dead girl has been raised. And so the report goes out to the whole region. That's going to be repeated again as well. You start to see the heightening of Jesus' ministry as it's starting to become really, really public. And so it continues like this. And it says, as Jesus was going away from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, have mercy on us, son of David. And when he came into the house, the blind men approached him. And Jesus said to them, do you believe that I am able to do this? And they said to him, yes, Lord. Then he touched their eyes and saying, according to your faith or according to your trust, let it be done for you. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, saying, see that no one finds out. But they went out, and they spread the report about him in the whole region.
So the first thing I noticed about this section was this son of David line. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, because we've heard of people coming, you know, coming up behind Jesus and basically being like, please help me.
Mm-hmm.
But to be called son of David, that's not something that Jesus has referred to himself as in Matthew. I don't know about other.
The very last time we heard son of David was in Matthew chapter 1, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, in Matthew begins his gospel of this is, you know, this is
about his,
this is about the son of David.
Yeah.
You know,
But that's the last time we heard. Yeah. It's not something that Jesus has said on in his ministry, I guess. Right. He's used, son of man,
right.
Primarily. And so the son of David thing, was different, mm-hmm. especially having, I don't think again that it would be something that I would have noticed had we not been reading through all this. If we had randomly been like, let's read this story about when Jesus heals the blind, probably wouldn't have thought much of that.
Yeah.
But seeing that this is the first time, I almost read it as Son of Man just because we've read that so much. Yeah. But yeah, so that's kind of an interesting little.
Yeah. What I would say is that two blind men are the first people to see who Jesus is. Mm-hmm. Like really deep down. Like, so he hasn't called himself the Messiah. Like mm-hmm. you said, he's only used the phrase son of man, but to say son of David is really loaded. It's really loaded. You've got it's basically saying Messiah,
mm-hmm.
Because that's the one they're looking for. They're looking for a descendant of David, the person that's going to take up David's throne. And the reason it's really loaded is the majority of Israel is looking for a military leader to take David's throne and to overthrow the Romans. And so that's probably one of the main reasons Jesus really doesn't want to use it for himself is because of all the baggage that comes with it.
Yeah.
And
he's like, I'm not really going to raise an army like you think I am.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's here to, not in that way. He's here to overthrow a darker, more sinister oppressor.
Right.
And where he is going to overthrow, quote, the government of this world, it's not of man's government, it's of the oppressive government of you know, the evil one, the powers and principalities of the air, as Paul would put it, that really kind of pull the strings for all of that. The thing that even death that's up above that we've talked about, he's here to overthrow those things. And Rome is just a symptom of that. And even within Israel, they demonstrate the symptoms of that, of the effect of that. And so that's what he's here to overthrow. But to say the son of David out loud, it was just like, you know, I think you can kind of get a sense of it is that he doesn't really respond to them until he gets inside the house. So it's almost like he doesn't want that to get spread too much right now. Whenever we start talking about the Messiah, he wants to reframe what the Messiah even is, in accordance with the scriptures. It's really loaded, but it's like these two blind men are the first ones to really see it, that you're the Messiah. And they call on him for mercy, which has a distinct echo just right before, right? Whenever Jesus said, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, in quoting Hosea 6:6, these men, they cry out, and again, they cry out. We've heard this before as well, that continually throughout the scriptures, God's people, they cry out to him, and whenever they cry out to him, he answers, just like in the Exodus narrative. Israel's cry out in their bondage, and he sets them free. This is Jesus demonstrating and walking the talk of the mercy that he talked about before, and even deeper than just, again, the delivery from wrongdoing, you know, or not punishing, of actually the steadfast love of God, the covenantal love of God. They beckon him for it. And so then whenever he comes into the house, again, it looks like, it seems to me that he's kind of looking for some separation and some secrecy, or really solitude from the outside world, especially mm-hmm. in dealing with this situation whenever they call him son of David. And then he addresses their faith. You have any other thoughts on this section?
Well, just that, you know, going back to the last section of how nobody knew, or there were very few people in the room, so it was not something that people saw, but how that news still spread, obviously, because it's kind of hard. You're not just going to be like, okay, she's raised from the dead. Let's just hide her forever. Like, she's going to, people are going to see her out and about. Mm-hmm. But it's one thing, I think, for people to know about the miracles and kind of wonder, like, who is this Jesus guy really? Or for people to go, oh, maybe that girl wasn't really dead. Mm-hmm. You know, just kind of having these kind of questions and doubts. It's another, though, for a person to know, in fact, that he is the Messiah and that his mission is going to look much different than expected. Mm-hmm. So because it took me a minute to kind of make sense of like this whole going inside thing versus what we will see or what we have already seen in other miracles. Like the woman who was bleeding, there was obviously a crowd around for that. I mean, there's plenty of other miracles where there's people around. So it's like, what makes this one different? And it is probably the Son of David.
I think that's what makes it different, is the Son of David aspect.
And so I just, you know, I kind of thought that was interesting because that's, you know, people are just more curious about him and up to this point, but for somebody to address him already knowing who he is, mm-hmm. you know, is a difference.
Yeah. So this, do you believe that I'm able to do this? I don't think he's asked anybody else, like, do you believe or do you trust? And he searches for an answer for them. Of course, they say yes. This kind of goes back to before. Faith and trust has been a continuing theme in all of these miracle narratives. Even the disciples, right, in the storm, that he says, why you have such little faith, you have such little trust. Going back to the centurion, he says, I haven't seen trust or faith like this in all of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been a continuing theme in this. However, I don't think that it should be assumed that Jesus needs our trust in order to heal. Does that make sense? So he doesn't need us. We don't supply some ingredient for him to be able to do great works, right?
Right.
He doesn't need something from us in order to heal. Rather, I think he's tying trust in him to the binding up of the broken that Yahweh promised to do for his people, like from Hosea 6, you know, 1 through 2, which should have been recalled earlier. Of, you know, they say, come, let us return to Yahweh, because it is he who is torn and he will heal us. He has struck us down and he will bind us up. He will revive us after 2 days. And on the third day, will raise us up that we may live in his presence. He's demonstrating himself to be the one who is worthy of their trust. As the psalmist would write about, your righteousness I have not hidden in the midst of my heart. I have spoken of your trustworthiness in your salvation. I have not concealed your loyal love or your trustworthiness from the great congregation. As for you, O Yahweh, do not withhold your mercies from me. This is the cry of, like, you know, have mercy on us, right? Loyal love upon us. Let your loyal love and your faithfulness continually preserve me. And so that seems to be, like, he's doing these things that the psalmist is crying out for and speaking of his trustworthiness. So Jesus is the trustworthy one that the psalmist speaks about. And all these themes are playing out through Jesus' healing narrative of mercy, salvation, trustworthiness, and, you know, faithfulness. God is the one who can be leaned upon and trusted. And so all of those things have come up just in these little narratives. And so I think it's, again, demonstrating who he is. He is the trustworthy one. He invites us in. He wants us to be, we lean in on him. These people, they lean in on him and he responds. And so it demonstrates himself to be trustworthy. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
and so then he touches their eyes and he says, according to your trust or according to your faith, let it be done for you. I prefer trust, because faith just feels like such a weird word for us. It feels, no pun intended, but it feels blind.
See what you did there.
Yeah, but, you know, it's this trust. They've seen what he's done, and, you know, and so here They trust in him, and then it says that their eyes were open. And imagine, you know, they're the first ones to recognize to truly see him for who he is, and then that he's actually the first one that they see whenever their eyes are opened. Anyways, any other thoughts on this section?
Just the fact that, you know, Jesus tells them sternly, see that no one knows about this, and they go out and spread the news about what he had just done.
Anyways,
it kind of made me chuckle because I was thinking about our kids or any kids really, is when you tell them, especially seems like sternly, not to do something.
Yeah.
They immediately go, like, you can almost count on that. They're just testing their boundaries of like, I just got to try this. But also what I thought of, and I think that this could cover all what we have read, is I'm bringing up again, The Chosen, the theme. Well, I mean, the Chosen is going through a lot of these stories.
Sure.
Right now. But it's people must know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I thought of when I read that, of just after I laughed and thought about our kids, I thought about they have just experienced something completely life-changing and they know that the Messiah is here.
Yeah.
And their response is people must know.
Yeah. I just can't help it. They just can't help it.
Right.
I mean, even him sternly telling them, this man who's healed them, who is the Messiah, and they know it.
The ultimate backstab.
Yeah. They just are like, I can't help it. I mean, but that goes back to the Psalm for me. So I go back and I read Psalm 40, and Psalm 40 is like, I can't help but tell people of your trustworthiness, your salvation, your loyal love, your mercies. You know, like, mm-hmm. so it says, I haven't kept these things in my heart. Instead, I have told everybody about it.
Yeah.
And so I think that this goes really well with Psalm 40. And that's Psalm 40 verses 10 through 11, if you want to go check it out. But it's like the psalmist just can't even help contain himself whenever he thinks of God. And so just the same, these people, like, even with him sternly telling them, hey, keep it on the down low, they just can't help it. And then the same thing is repeated that was repeated in verse 26. They went out and they spread the report about him throughout that whole region. So you can just, again, Matthew's making the point, like, this is just starting to catch fire here.
People must know.
Yeah, everybody's starting to know, and it's going to, you know, might start creating some tension here. So let's finish this section out.
While they were going out, a man who was demon-possessed and could not talk was brought to Jesus. And when the demon was driven out, the man who had been mute spoke. The crowd was amazed and said, nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel. But the Pharisees said, it is by the prince of demons that he drives out demons.
Yeah, so this is a very straightforward healing here, where it seems like this demon is the one that's causing this person to be mute. I guess it's kind of adding to the list of, you know, Matthew's probably picked it because of the mute aspect of it. So that you've got blind, lame, leper. I mean, he's kind of adding all the things together so that there's a part later, whenever he's going to answer John's question, he's going to say all these different things. Yeah. So anyways, that's for a later spoiler alert for that. I think that's probably why he's picked it. Either way, it seems just fairly straightforward, but the point isn't maybe so much on the demon-possessed man as it is on the reactions, right? So you kind of have just two different reactions. So what are your thoughts on the two different reactions?
Well, the fact that there was people around to be a reaction was obviously, you know, very different from the last one. The crowds being amazed, and then I can just kind of picture the Pharisees standing there with their arms crossed, like really bitter about this, about yet another miracle happening publicly.
Yeah. It just seems really sad, you know, that they're so frustrated with so much good.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the same time, I have to wonder, you know, for myself, like, do I allow myself to be happy for good things that happen? And, you know, instead of just being a Scrooge, you know, or, you know, and I don't know, doubting the truth of what somebody says, you know, and mm-hmm. be more, because I'm so much more of a analytical person, you know, I think I just doubt a lot more of, you know, stories that people tell me, stuff like that. And so, so it seems like such a shame that they can't find joy in this. And instead they just look for reasons to refute it.
Yeah.
Even though it's so obvious.
Well, I think, and it's kind of ironic too, that they are the ones who are blind to who Jesus really is. Exactly. So you kind of have, and you know, these stories are kind of, again, like the last two were kind of meshed together with the girl who had passed away and the woman who was bleeding. Now you have this, like, these paired together, and they seem kind of like, you know, you're kind of making a point here where the blind see who Jesus really is, and the Pharisees can't see who Jesus really is.
Yeah, and you know, and it kind of goes back to blessed are the poor, you know, but you know, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. It's like continually God's theme throughout the entirety of Scripture is that He reveals Himself through the small, you know, the unimportant, and that is who He chooses, to work through. And the Pharisees seems to have lost their way with that. I mean, they could be that, you know, and they kind of choose not to be. They'd rather, their hearts have become hard, to what Jesus is doing. And, you know, so, R.T. France writes this about this last section. He says, as, this is the final crowd reaction, in this anthology of works of power, we should read it as an evaluation, not merely of this one exorcism, but of the whole range of Jesus' miracles. So this is kind of a reaction. This has never been before seen in Israel. Isn't necessarily a reaction just to this exorcism, but to all the miracles that we've seen so far. Because things, like I've mentioned earlier, Elijah and Elisha healed, you know, they rose children from the dead. But nobody has ever done this much stuff, you know, like all at once. To continue, it says, others might perform the occasional exorcism, but this man's ministry of deliverance is on a whole other, altogether different scale. A similarly climatic effect, but in ominously different direction, is achieved by the Pharisees' accusation. They do not deny Jesus' power. I think that's really important. They, within Matthew's story, they don't deny that Jesus has the power to do all these things. Like that you would maybe expect to be like, all this is mumbo jumbo.
Mm-hmm.
They don't deny that any of this has happened. What their claim is that he gets authority from a different place.
Yeah.
Of which that they should know better than to realize. I mean, and they're going to get pushback on this later in Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, you should know better. Like that doesn't, what you're saying makes no sense. But that's how you're justifying it to yourself.
As demons don't have authority over life and death.
and the waters, you know, waters, like these are the things that only Yahweh has power over and you know it.
Yeah.
So they don't deny Jesus' power, but question its source. Such a total and offensive repudiation of his authority brings the growing hostility to a new level and suggests a breach of which is now irreparable. So you can see now the separation where it seemed like they were maybe curious before. Now you can start to see like they're being like, this is not, they're becoming enemies, you know, of mm-hmm. Jesus. And so as the story develops, we have to see how that kind of plays out. But yeah, we see this, these two different, maybe three different reactions. One's that they're amazed for the blind, maybe the blind men are really kind of a part of this section, and maybe we shouldn't have broken it up like you had suggested. You know, it's kind of all part of the section where they trust in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The crowds are kind of like astonished and like their minds are blown. And then for the Pharisees, they are obviously hardened against him and saying, I'm not going to accept any of this. And so it makes you think, like, what are our reactions to Jesus? Do we just say, do we trust in him as the Messiah and say, you are the son of David? Like, I know who you are. I know that you're the king of Israel. Or are we just more like, Jesus is kind of awesome. Like, all these healings are really cool, but he's still, you know, just treat him as a, you know, a cool guy that does mm-hmm. nice things. Or are we saying that I'm totally against him. And so Matthew is putting forward kind of three different reactions to Jesus, and begs the question, what's your reaction, you know, and who are you going to be? So that's I think what we have to go forward with here. So we will finish chapter 9 next week. I felt like it fit better with the beginning of chapter 10. So
yeah, you just want to restructure the Bible, don't you?
Well, you know, well, somebody else did. No, these things don't have verses in them whenever you read it in its original language. Okay. But anyways, so I pray that this has been beneficial to you, and grace and peace, friends.